Good evening. Welcome. I've not met you before.
I'm Jason.
Glad to meet you. I'm Patrick. Hope you can stay a little bit afterwards and meet some of the others over tea and discussion at the end. So, welcome. I want to continue the talk that I started last month. So this is a two-parter, or as we were saying in Jean's class, a twofer. And I spoke a little bit last time about transmission ceremony. In general, and I used the transmission of the seventh ancestor, Vasumitra, in particular. Let me just say that this will segue from the main topic in that transmission story was the concept of purification, purifying the mind. And this one will segue into kind of don't know mind. And so I'll a little bit about don't know mind that I visit every day. It's regarding my two cats that I've had for 3 years. And they're probably litter mates or at least the same age. They came from a house filled with lots of cats, and unfortunately their owner went to the nursing home and the 27 cats that she owned went to the pound, and I was just once again fortunate to have to share my house with the two most perfect cats ever, and they get along okay, and I think I kind of understand their relationship. Cleo is the dominant one, and Delmar usually bows out. Cleo gets her way. Cleo definitely gets the lap, and Delmar gets the feet that are left over. Cleo actually tells us at night where all of us get to sleep on the bed. And Delmar sort of gets third choice. And his choice is always kind of lower towards my feet than she is. So if she's sort of at the waist, he's at the feet. If she's up at chest level, he can be at hip level. But, so it's kind of funny. So I think that's it. Delmar though has full reign of the food bowls. He gets first choice of which bowl he wants, and he also he's out most of the time. She's in most of the time. When he comes in at the end of the day, he has the run of the house, and he's kind of the boss for a few brief minutes. Whenever they really fight, he always wins. So this is the, you know, I don't know about this domination thing or who's the dominant one. But for instance, the control of the bed is done just with her look, with a look. I mean, there's no fighting. It's just a glance in his direction, and he will move. So probably animal behaviorists know exactly what's on their mind, and I think I do, but it proves me wrong every once in a while. So I have to hold my ideas about who's in charge a little lightly, and it seems to change in different positions. So I guess the take-home message is this kind of idea of don't know mind, or holding something kind of lightly is not such an unusual state of mind. It's about house cats. It's about how we hold those about our pets, and what do we think we know about our partners or our husbands or wives? You know, that's another degree of complexity, and I'm sure those of you who are coupled up have to hold that mind, that don't know mind, carefully, lightly, and you're pretty familiar with, I think I know what he's thinking. I think I know what's going on here, but I don't want to hold on too tightly because I could also be totally off base. So this idea of don't know mind is not some mystical meditative state. So Vasumitra, the seventh ancestor. So this is about 150 years after Buddha. This is just a review. He was the town drunk, and he pounded his mug on the table in front of the sixth ancestor, Mishaka. And the sixth ancestor says, "Is that my mug or is that your mug?" And as he was pondering it, he had an awakening. You know, the stories always go like that. You know, this is his first time going to a Zen center. He gets awakened. And then the idea that comes out of that, that's explained to us by Keizan, who compiled the third ancestor after Dogen. So we're talking now in the middle of the 1300s, the Japanese Soto Zen priest compiled all these ancestor stories. So Keizan gives a little lesson, and he talks about the idea of purification, that the idea of purifying your mind is not landing on this or that. If you can identify the mug as mine or yours, it's not really true. If it has a characteristic, it's not really that. In the ultimate sense, it's not really a mug. We can go on and on. We can say, it's metal. You know, it didn't start out in the world thinking, I'm metal that belongs to a mug. I'm just, so on one sense, in the ultimate sense, it is just metal that the causes and conditions of the universe have, made into a mug shape that now belongs to, something called a human. So that's one way of thinking about the ultimate nature of this thing that conventionally we call a mug. So to purify the mind is not to get stuck in ideas. When I think about a presidential candidate holding a prayer rally, I just tighten up. And yet, if the same candidate had said, "Let's just sit a little bit and follow our breath," I'd have a whole different idea. So I have to say that this is where I've got this thing pretty tight. I've got this barb in my mind that gets stuck around this fellow, and purifying the mind is just sort of identifying that there's this barb there. Maybe I can soften it up. Maybe at his next event, he will have a meditation, and it'll just evaporate, but at least I'm aware that I've got this kind of barb, you know, where I get stuck, where I've got this fixed idea, and that's an area that I have to work on. So this idea of purifying the mind is just trying to identify where we get stuck, and can we possibly hold things lightly? Can we possibly hold all things? Can we hold both sides carefully? Can we keep both sides close in? Not reject something, not pull something in too closely. Can we just hold something closely? Two things, two opposites, all things. So that was Vasumitra's awakening the things that I think I know, I need to hold on to a little more lightly. I need to be aware of where I'm stuck and not get in trouble because I'm stuck, because I've got these barbs. So one imagines that he becomes a great Zen teacher. Of course he did. It says so. And 25 years later, he's got a student named Buddhanandi, the eighth ancestor. The eighth patriarch, Buddhanandi, met the seventh patriarch, Vasumitra. And Vasumitra said, Buddhanandi said to Vasumitra, "I have come to discuss the truth with you." And Vasumitra said, "Good sir, if you discuss, it is not the truth. Truth is not discussed. If you intend to discuss the truth, then in the end, it is not a discussion of the truth." And at this point, Buddhanandi realized Vasumitra's truth was superior and was awakened to the principle of the unborn. Let's just say that truth, let's think of truth here as what's the ultimate, what's the absolute? And the absolute, you know, doesn't have a beginning or an end. It's true, or it's absolute, or it's the ultimate, without beginning and without end. So that's how we should maybe think of with this realization into what could maybe the direction of the ultimate. He had an insight into the principle of the unborn, the ultimate. This sounds a lot like, don't think so hard about it. Don't form a fixed idea. Try to avoid, having a fixed idea about the ultimate or what the absolute is. Hold it lightly. And that was Vasumitra's discussion. If you discuss it, that's probably not it. If you think too hard about it, that's probably not it. Go in the direction there, but don't start fixing any ideas about it. So it's a little like the same idea of purifying the mind or being identifying where you get stuck. So a little history. Kazan gives us a little history about Buddhanandi. He was from Kamala and actually belonged to the Gotama family. He was a distant relative of the Buddha. And he even had the family fleshy protuberance on his head. That's one of the 32 signs of a Buddha. And you can just imagine how attractive that is. He was an intelligent fellow, Kazan says. His debate was unstoppable. It was, and So he was quite a thinker. He was learned. He was articulate. And maybe he'd been studying Buddhism. I mean, he was a family member after all. And then this discussion with Vasumitra, saying, you know, kind of dislodged him just enough that he had kind of an opening. Kazan in all of these chapters, each chapter on the next ancestor, gives a little lecture about the awakening experience, a little Zen talk. And his talk focuses on non-duality. Even if that mind and objects are not two, this is not a discussion of reality. If you say that nothing changes, or even that everything changes, these aren't true either. If you say that words cannot be uttered, or that the principle cannot be revealed, this still does not penetrate reality. If you say that essential nature is real, or that the mind is the absolute, what sort of discussion is this? If you say that subject and object are both forgotten, this is still not a real discussion. Even if subject and object are not forgotten, this is still not the truth. Though you speak of guest and host, one or identical, again, this is not a discussion of truth. So, I think the direction is clear. The question is a fair question. Keep going with that question. But be careful when you feel like you've got it. Be careful when you feel like you've heard something and that you won't have to study it anymore, because you can always go to that one explanation and take it from there. You know, I'm just remembering in college the first time around, I was an art student, and I can remember taking a drawing class, and we would have like Dokusan with the drawing teacher. We would, you know, every week or two, we would sit with him for 10-15 minutes and show him our drawings. And I can remember saying something like, you know, and it was all drawing from life. You know, we drew our portraits in the mirror. We had models that we drew from. So it was about the human form. I can remember saying something about, you know, I can remember the term repertoire of noses. You know, I wasn't so happy with a nose here or a nose there. And I minimized it. I said, I've just got to get noses down. That was my idea. But I said the term a repertoire of noses. You know, I've got to get a few noses down and then they'll work. And he knew exactly what I was thinking. And he, this was maybe my first Zen lesson. He said, no, you know, every time you have to do it just the way you see it that time alone. And it really, you know, I was, you know, college student, 18, 19. I could have been written up in this. This was my awakening moment. Now, of course, I didn't become a great artist, but, I wasn't named the next great thing, but that was really an eye opener. And it was exactly this. I shouldn't just get something in my head and then not have to worry about it. I always go right to the Democratic ticket. I don't think otherwise. I mean, that's the same sort of thing. I've got it so that I don't have to think about it anymore. I've just got this repertoire on. I was instructed not to have a repertoire. And Vasu Mitra once again is saying, don't get stuck. Go in that direction. Stay in this drawing class. You're on the right track, but don't get stuck. When you think you know it, go on to the next thing and see it as the unique thing right here and there. Kazan goes on, he says sort of jokingly, you know, because, you know, there's volumes of sutras written by, or spoken by the Buddha and all of his students. You know, he starts saying that, you know, even Manjushri speaking of, with this in mind, even Manjushri speaking of no words and no speech is not an announcement of reality. Neither is Vimalakirti's sitting in silence a discussion of the truth. Even less Shariputra. You know, we chant about Shariputra's revelation in the Heart Sutra every morning. So he even says all the great thinkers of Buddhism that you've been reading about, even their discussions of the truth, please hold with a grain of salt. And but this is a nice thing. But he says about bodhisattvas that you know they practice 10 levels of a meditative development to become a bodhisattva. In the 10 abodes, they are unable to see Buddha nature. The ultimate, another term for the ultimate, and you know, Kokyo has been talking about the concept of Buddha nature, but the bodhisattvas can do, you know, 10 deeper and deeper samadhis, and they're still unable to see the ultimate. But if the Tathagata explains it, they see a little, and when they've seen just a little, then they say, wonderful, oh world-honored one, we have transmigrated in samsara for countless eons and have always been perplexed about the absence of self. So this is another clue that these places where we develop barbs, where we get stuck, are it's the way we are. It's our natural karmic tendency that we've inherited as humans, but it's really about the self. It's really about close in, and so this question: How can I see the truth? How can I see the ultimate? How do I aim towards the ultimate? Here's another clue that it's about looking closely at yourself. And maybe it's about the same idea of purifying the mind, of looking where you get stuck. That this very mind is going to lead you in the direction of the ultimate. So this is, and Kazan points out that this wasn't his idea, that this line about, oh, wonderful, wonderful, we've always been perplexed about the absence of the self, comes from Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra. So this has come out in which Kokyo has identified as part of this third turning of the Dharma wheel. Kazan directs us towards the awakening of Dongshan. Although he was one with myriad things and understood that the whole of existence preaches the Dharma, his teacher, he still didn't think, Dongshan still didn't think his understanding was enough. His teacher directed him to keep working with this question. And lo and behold, he was crossing a stream and he saw his reflection in the water, and suddenly he grasped the matter and he wrote this poem. Avoid seeking him, capital him, which is Buddha, Buddha nature, the ultimate. or the interconnectedness of all things, the dynamic functioning of the universe, all of the ways that we can say ultimate or absolute. Avoid seeking him in someone else, or you will be far apart from the self. He has a capital S there, self. Solitary now am I, and independent, but I meet him everywhere. He is now surely me, but I am not him. Understand it in this way, and you will directly be one with thusness. I meet him everywhere. He is surely me, but I am not him. So this is a way that we sometimes talk about our relationship with the ultimate. That we are the ultimate. That we're not separate from it. It's not an object that we need to go to. We're part of this interconnected universe at all time. But we're also, uniquely Patrick, because of causes and conditions, I've been given this name and I'm related to this family and I've come to live in Santa Cruz. There's also these kind of unique things about ourselves, and we can hold both of those ideas simultaneously. We're one with the universe, and we are unique. I can tell the difference between me and Sheila. I can see Sheila. I have the perception that I'm separate and unique, and that's my karmic inheritance. And I'm still part of the ultimate interconnectedness of things. So that's how I'm interpreting. He is surely me, but I'm not this. That's that holding both things at the same time. And how do you think, why do you think he had that experience then, seeing his reflection? What do you think? We're just fantasizing here because it doesn't say. What do you think his frame of mind could have been that he was away? What do you think the frame of mind of anybody is when they have that glimpse, the bodhisattvas, when they see that little glimpse of the ultimate? Another Chinese ancestor had that glimpse, when he was sweeping the gravel and he heard the sound of the gravel hitting bamboo. It somehow awakened him. What do you think? What do you think that frame of mind is about? Any ideas? Kathy?
Yeah. In Dongshan's case, it's almost like he had kind of given up. When he was crossing the river, it was after he'd said goodbye to his teacher. It was kind of like, oh well, I'm never really going to get it. And so he had let go of trying. And I'm thinking, we were talking about that Sunday evening in our discussion group, of that experience when you stop trying. I had told an example of, or said, that when I was trying to be an artist, that the picture looked more forced and stilted. But I had gotten feedback from somebody who is a really good artist about a picture that I had drawn out of this total not knowing, even judging, this is a bunch of junk. I don't know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then what actually arose was very alive. And someone else shared about the same with writing. It's just stop trying.
Yeah.
Stop trying to come from this identity of who you think you are. And then it's almost interesting things can come to us, mm-hmm. because we're not putting our interpretation on the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I can't say that. That's not a good thing to say exactly. I think that's in the right direction. And it's the same direction that Kazan was saying here in the non-duality piece, you know, where even if you say subject and object are forgotten. So when it stopped being an object of, I really want to understand this, you know, then he was more open to the experience. Where was that said? But the experience of just being, you know, right there. I think I've talked about, you know, the thing that keeps me coming back. I'm certainly not saying that I'm enlightened. I don't think any Soto practitioner, that's not what we're taught to talk about or to aim for. But we all have these little glimpses that keep us coming back. And I've talked about, you know, being in on a hike. You know, maybe like your hike coming up in a week. You know, where you go over the ridge, you're in nature and you're loving it anyway, and you go over the ridge and you've just got this breathtaking experience of the vastness of the universe and how it's all, you know, interconnected. I mean, I can't get away from that word. You really see the interconnectedness of this vast plateau, and you're a part of it. So you have, you know, for a moment that glimpse, and you know, brought on by, you know, just saying, you know, I really like hiking. I'm going to go for a hike, and you're in this frame of mind where you're open, and then lo and behold, something does come to you in a unique way. So that's, I think that's the direction that Kazan has suggested, and what Kathy suggested, and the experience that I've had, you know, in nature. And so I'm imagining there was Dongshan, you know, walking, you know, with this frame of mind of leaving his teacher. I don't have the right understanding. I'm going to have to go someplace else. But being in nature, and lo and behold, you know, with just a little bit jarred out of his usual area of comfort, he has this moment of awakening. Kazan comments on this poem. Therefore, if you thoroughly abandon that approach, which is, you know, having an understanding of the ultimate as your mind, as your object, as your goal. If you abandon that and thoroughly experience this place, this body, this place, you will be able to become a Buddha. So Kazan is really directing us to look, as Dogen said, you know, this is the place. Here the way unfolds. Investigate this mind. Try to understand the barbs that have been concretized over and over. Try to understand this body and mind. Our morning chants, you know, that we do each morning, they tend to be some of the fundamental teachings of the Soto school has identified as, you know, this is our way. We chant this over and over. In the Song of the Trusting Mind, the third ancestor, the third Chinese ancestor, Jansi Senkan, or Kanchi Sosan is the way we chant it in Japanese, He says, stop talking, stop thinking, and there is nothing that you won't be able to know. So he says, stop this, you know, ruminative figuring out, and just try to experience what's right here. Be open to the experience, the universe as it comes to you. But when I come across that line, I always do it with a parenthesis, with a exclamation point. Stop talking and thinking, and there's nothing you won't be able to know. We've started the chant Dogen's Bendawa, his self-fulfilling samadhi, where he says that that this samadhi of experiencing the self and letting the universe reveal itself, this receptive samadhi, does not appear with perception. So he's saying the same thing that that Vasumitra said. You can't talk about the truth. You can't just discuss the truth. You can't have a debate. Buddhananda, you know, was skilled in debating. You can't debate yourself into this understanding among your Dharma family. It doesn't appear within perception, but in the but it's unconstructedness and stillness. So there's something about, you know, it's not constructed, but there's a constructedness aspect to it, and it's done in stillness. So this is the same idea: it's there is the ultimate. There is the interconnectedness of all things. We've had that experience going over the ridge and seeing it for a moment. But we can't think about it. It's unconstructedness and stillness. And so what is this frame of mind? I want to go back to what we think this frame of mind is, or this, I contend, like my ideas about holding ideas lightly, that it's pretty ordinary. Of course, we're always directed towards the attitude and the posture of zazen. You know, we're resting in this symmetrical, balanced posture. Whatever posture it is we take in zazen, not necessarily this cross-legged posture, but whatever it is, whatever posture, it's restful, it's symmetrical, it's balanced. And the mind, the thoughts come up, and we just, as Uchiyama says, we open the hand of thought. We don't ruminate on the thoughts. We let them go like clouds through that slowly cross through the empty sky. We don't make those concrete barbs, and we just come back to our body, to our breath. So this is this idea of holding the ultimate and the conventional at once. They're not opposites. Holding them both together closely, we are directed towards zazen for that. How do we talk about mindfulness? Our mindfulness practice, where as much as possible stay close to this body and mind. Throughout the day, we do practices to underline our mindfulness. When the phone rings, we maybe just let it ring a couple of times and experience our body before we pick it up, so that we're in this body and mind. So whatever the universe is sending us over the telephone lines, we can greet it with that with that mind of spaciousness, that ready mind, that receptive mind that we imagine that that Dongshan had when he was awakened at his reflection. Those little glimpses that the bodhisattvas have that keep them, you know, wanting to do this practice, that says, okay, I'm at the ninth samadhi stage. I can do it again. I can shoot for number 10. Or, gee, I was just at the Zen Center yesterday. I can go back again. So that's how we kind of keep that mind, in the forefront, where we can experience the universe as it comes to us. And when we find ourselves sort of cursing at the TV about another prayer rally, we can say, you know, I forgot that mind. In Jean's class, Sunday night, we talked about that idea of right understanding, you know, keeping that idea of interconnectedness, or keeping that receptive, not picking or choosing mind in the forefront at all times. You know, that was one of Buddha's, that was his first lecture upon his awakening, that the first of his eightfold path was keeping this mind in the forefront of your life. And he wasn't saying at this point, you know, it wasn't about, you know, this is a great mystical samadhi state. This is the fourfold, or the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path is about how to be liberated from suffering in this very life. You know, not the mind of the yogi or the ascetic. It's about how to be liberated in this very life, and that's the first of the Eightfold Path is just keep remembering that we are all connected intimately. So it's not a unique samadhi state. It's something we can visit with our cats, with our significant other. It's something we can visit in Zazen. It's something that we can visit as we're chanting here in the morning in our ceremonies that we do here every day, enlivens that frame of mind. We've got a few more minutes. We've got about 6 minutes. Any thoughts? Lori.
As I was listening to you, the word curiosity just kept coming up. The idea of we can only be curious about what's in front of us. And also the idea of not too tight, not too loose. So be curious enough to be engaged. Because if you don't have some focus or engagement, then it's just like, whatever, you know, who cares? But to be able to be curious in a way that's not too tight and not too loose seems like a way to connect to that, to get a sense of that interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm.
To be curious about, you know, what's going on with the person that he would say something like that or do something like that.
Yeah.
So the idea of curiosity just kept coming back when I was listening.
Yeah, and of course that's the teaching of a beginner's mind, you know, staying curious. The 19-year-old student in drawing class who admits that he, you know, doesn't know a nose from you know, the other end, is receptive to this, you know, just stay open. And yeah, I want to stay curious. The other half of the teaching on beginner's mind is the expert kind of knows it all, and it's kind of rigid. So keeping that beginner's mind, keeping that curiosity, that is what this is.
The expert was going to get five noses down.
He's drawn so much that he knows a lot about noses. Right. He might have 100 noses, but he's not. But in his mind, there's not 101 possible noses. That's the teaching. Remember when Beata was asking a question of your lecture on. She talked about the creative process, and that's the curiosity reminds me of Beata was talking about there's no she doesn't have a formula for working with chronic pain. She's found it very exciting. She's found it that it's very creative, that rather than there's that pain again, she in her practice has felt that this is very creative to work with this, and so that's your term curiosity triggered me and said, this is exciting. Of course I want to keep coming back here and sitting in this posture, because that nurtures my creativity. It nurtures this curiosity about the universe. I can always go, no, not it, not it. But what? What keeps me going? Even Dongshan was convinced, was kept his curiosity, even though he was a little discouraged, with his understanding. He still was curious. And any other thoughts? We've got a couple minutes. Sheila.
Well,
I'm
just
curious about how you handled your art. Identifying them is the first step. Being willing to identify them. Getting mad at the TV set about a prayer breakfast. Voting the straight Democratic ticket wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, but it's not a particularly creative solution, and it's not so exciting to always have the same reaction and always. check the same box. So the fact that I can identify this barb and other places where I get stuck, and then as we were talking with Lori, saying, I'm curious about this. I'm curious about this in my own life. I've gotten stuck. I've really suffered around this, and I know that looking at that barb, understanding it, knowing when it comes up the strongest, I can have some of these little glimpses, these little bodhisattva glimpses of something bigger, something more spacious, a little bit more. I can have a little more ease around this. We're already, every newscast is from now until November is going to be about something about the election. This is going to be a long. This is going to be a long 18 months. If every time I watch the news, I'm going to be cursing and swearing. So I've got to create a creative solution, or I know my sufferings. So just being aware, making it a creative direction rather than, you know, oh, I've got to get rid of this or I'm going to be in trouble, or oh, I don't want to face this again. But this could, you know, this could be the start of something big. I could have that frame of mind, and that would be a little opening. And you know, it might not change my ultimate voting behavior, but I might have a little more openness. Thank you very much.
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them.
Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to save them. Surpassable.